This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This is iFanboy Pick of the Week, number 730, brought to you by Quarantine, the new comic book now available on Kickstarter. And iFanboy listeners just like you who are washing their hands.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Pick of the Week, episode 730, exclamation point. I'm Josh Flanagan, and this is my co-host, Connor Kilpatrick, period.
I did a double take when I saw 730, even though each week it's a new number that goes up. When we hit a new plateau, I go, whoa, even now after 15 years.
I always liken it to, like, would this get a special issue? Would this get, like, 32 pages instead of 24? No. But 5 issues ago, 725 might have. 750, definitely.
In the old days, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not this one.
Well, we would have also, if we did it the way comics did, we'd be on episode 8.
Right, that's true.
So let's go. We are iFanboy and normally read our comic books and talk about them and have fun. But as we know, nothing is normal right now, including the comics industry. So we're just, we're making it up as we go along. There's a pick. We have been talking about comics, not even tangentially, just not in the same way that we have in the past. And we've also been talking about G.I. Joe, you may be aware. And we will be doing that later.
It's fun.
For the foreseeable future. It's a lot of fun.
You got to find your fun. That's the thing.
Oh, yeah.
There's a crushing reality out there. So I have a whiskey, and we're finding our fun. I just spilled that whiskey on myself.
I'm not really a drinker, and I can't eat chocolate cake while we do this, but that's what I would be doing. I would be eating chocolate cake.
Last weekend I was on the couch, and I was like, I really want a cake. And I remembered I had a cake mix, and I had a frosting, and within an hour I had a cake, and there's one piece left because I've been trying to ration it.
Right, right. Well, you got to hurry, though, because at a certain point, it starts to get bad.
Oh, it gets dry, but I have it in a very tight cake thing. This is not a show about cakes.
Yo, baby, you got some tight cake. There will be spoilers about cake. And also, if I offer you a challenge, because I suspect there are people out there like this who thought, I don't care about G.I. Joe. I didn't watch it. Yeah. I say just give one of these a run, even if you don't know. Just give it a shot. Connor, you had the pick, and now what that means is you say, how about this random book? Except this isn't random.
Yeah, here's the thing. So there are comics coming out. We're going to talk about some of them. But as we said last week, until things are like back to a recognizable normal, we're still going to stick with this unusual format. So DC put out 5 or 6 books. Marvel put out 1 book. There was some other companies that put out books. So we're going to talk about a couple of those books. And Marvel announced this week they're going to put out some digital books in a couple of weeks. So by the end of May, we're going to get more of a semblance of a normal situation, but we're still not there yet. So we're still going to stick with what we've been having fun doing during this time and also talking about what comes out. But that's just, you know, people ask, why didn't you pick one of the regular books? Because things are not normal yet.
Yeah. And, you know, the offering, not the strongest. And I don't think it will be.
Not a strong offering. And also, we had talked, Josh and I, you know, about what kind of books. Normally, we don't really plan out what we're going to talk about for Pick of the Week. It usually happens that week. But after last week, I was like, do you want to do New Frontier? Because we haven't really talked about it in a serious way in a long time. And so nothing was going to beat that this week. So,
well, I said to you, well, we make sure if I read it, I can't read the other books after it because I would hate them.
The Pick of the Week is DC, The New Frontier. It's volume one. It's not the whole thing. It's volume one, which is the first three issues, which came out in 2004. The issues came out in 2004, and then the first trade came out in 2004.
If you have the trade, that means that you are reading through chapter seven.
Right. So the point where the Martian Manhunter realizes that the danger is out there when he has the freak out when he opens the book. That's the point where this we stop. So story night by Darwin Cook, colors by Dave Stewart, letters by Jared K. Fletcher. I was reading this today, finishing it this morning, and I don't think I've read this all the way through in a long time. I have the digital copy on my iPad. I read it in the Absolute Edition, which is really the best way to read this book because of the art. I have two copies of the Absolute Edition. I have a hardcover of the Deluxe Edition, which is the same thing you get on Comixology. I have the Deluxe Edition on the Comixology. And so I'm always constantly referring to it. I have Darwin Cook art on my walls. I have Darwin Cook New Frontier toys in my bedroom. New Frontier is constantly around me physically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm constantly pulling the book out and looking at it, but I haven't sat down and actually read it in a long time. And so what was great was that a lot of this, I remember the high points, I remember the scenes I really liked, I remember the sequences I really liked, but there's stuff in there that I totally had forgotten about. So in a way, it was almost reading it again for the first time, and my gosh, my golly, as Marshall Manhunter would say, what a book.
Yeah, I think I read it, I want to say shortly after Darwin passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But it might have been before that. But it wasn't so long ago, but long enough that I don't, you know, remember the details. But as I went through, I mean, that gosh golly thing is definitely the case. I remember getting to the end of the first chapter in this and just going, that might be the finest single issue of a comic book I've ever read.
It's important to note that at the time this came out, it was before the podcast. It was the year before mm-hmm. we started the podcast. Podcasts weren't a thing yet. And I went back and looked, and I think I was the only one who read it. Initially,
you were. I read the first issue. I had no idea what it was, and I didn't get it. And I wasn't. One of my problems as a human is that I will issue something very quickly. But one of my strengths is that usually, if something is really great, it will come back to
You'll
me. All the wonderful
it.
Things of
Scalped. All, you wonderful things. Scalped after the first issue. You came yeah. back to it later.
Radiohead, The Beatles, many books. You know, like if I'm not ready for something, I'm not. But when it comes around, like I'm like, oh, that's my thing, and I will get it. And it was or Jack Kirby. Like when I'm not ready, I'm not ready. And then when I am, you know, I hate that young me is stupid. But it's not like I didn't get to it eventually.
I just wanted to point out issues 4 and 6 were picks of the week.
Okay.
You know, it was a long time ago. I don't
know. The written kind?
Yeah, the written kind before the show. I don't know if I just didn't have it on the weeks where they came out or what, or I didn't, you know, who knows? Because, you know, there's a lot of things that have to fall in place for a book to get picked the week, but 2 of the 6 got pick of the week back then. I mean, it was something that we recognized as quality at the time. At least I did as a reading. I'm pretty sure Ron wasn't reading at the time. Anyway, this is just preamble to set up sort of where we are with New Frontier, because we talk about it all the time. Obviously, we're huge fans of Darwin Cook, and we became friends with him through doing this. But this is his masterpiece, even though he's done lots of great things over the years. And reading it again, poring over the pages in the Absolute Edition, I was just constantly sending Josh screen captures. Look at this. Oh, my God, this panel. Oh, my God, this panel. Oh, my God, this panel.
I'm flipping through it right now. And you know, like, when you take, like, a bite of something that's really good. Imagine, like, perfectly prepared pork belly.
Yeah.
And it hits your tongue and it melts a little and you just go, oh. And your body sort of just loses its rigidity for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I've just done that. 4 times. I'm not exaggerating, just flipping through it. Like you key it to a panel or a page. There's a bit where Wally is like reclining on a beach, you know, drinking a juice or something. And then there's the page where Superman goes into the hut in Vietnam or Cambodia and Wonder Woman is like arms up in the air. There's Ted Knight victorious, you know, at the, you know, and this is just the beginning.
Ted Grant.
Yeah, Wildcat. Ted Knight. Yeah, that's wrong. Then there's like a shot of Lois sitting like in front of a bunch of army soldiers in tanks that are coming down a hill, and Jimmy's there with the helmet covered his face. Like, oh.
Well, one of the reasons I want to talk about this book, besides the fact that it's terrific, is that we're better at this thing now than we have talked about in the past. And so I don't think I ever really noticed the structure of it before, in that he does it in mostly 3-panel strips each page, where it's 3 almost widescreen panels. He came from animation, from doing this.
Tony Harris style.
Yeah, and then whenever there's a big moment, he punctuates it with a full page splash. You know, the guy jumping into the dinosaur, or Wonder Woman standing up with her arms up, or with the first time Hal sees what Ferris is really doing, or Ted Grant's victory over Muhammad Ali.
Batman fighting. Actually, though, that's a two panels of the three panel page, but still.
I'd forgotten that it was sort of it's sort of this strip format, and then he hits you a pow in the face with the full page shot when there's a real big moment.
Yeah,
it works really well. It works with his art style really well, and you don't lose any storytelling. You might think on the surface this sounds really boring. He does break it up occasionally with six panel grids and other kind of grids, but it's mostly these three grids. You might think it's boring, but his art is so served by the space and the room in each panel. And he's a master at telling a story within a panel that he doesn't need eight panels per page to tell a beautiful story. He doesn't need it. In fact, it's better this way because he's not confined. He's not constrained by it.
Yeah. At one point, we were talking to him. I think it was on one of the shows. And it was around the time that he was doing Parker. Mm-hmm. And basically, he said something along the lines of, you know, I've developed a style which lets me make sure I get through things quickly and, you know, well and, you know, don't get behind on, you know, his deadlines. Basically, he was saying, you know, he's learned to be efficient.
Mm-hmm.
I know what that looks like because I know what Parker looks like. And I know that his style did change over. If you look at the Jonah Hex issues that he did later, and it is simpler than what is in New Frontier.
Oh, this is like a epic.
He didn't overdo it at all. But clearly there's a watch what I can do thing going on here. The composition of everything is interesting. There's no skimping and shortcuts. And I don't mean to say that his later work looks bad or too simplistic. It doesn't. But I can spot shortcuts. And they're not necessarily bad. They're stylistic. It makes it look good. It fits. But there's just more going on here. And, you know, I've said this for quite a while. Certainly over the last, I want to say, 10 years. This is my favorite superhero story.
Mm-hmm.
Just full stop. I've always said Preacher's my favorite comic or whatever, and it is. But as far as superhero stories, I can't think of another one that I like more than this.
So, if you haven't read it, and many people haven't, and I would urge you and encourage you and implore you to do so.
It was free digitally like a week or two ago. I don't know if it still is, like on DC Digital.
This is a nice companion piece to our last pick of the week, which was the JSA, the Golden Age. So that story ends with the transition from the Golden Age to the Silver Age. But this story, it sort of starts at that point. It's not a sequel, but it starts at that same sort of point where the Justice Society has retired due to the HUAC committees, and there's a need for new heroes to rise. It's almost like the first three issues are the preamble, because the main character, Hal Jordan, doesn't even get his ring yet. He doesn't have his ring till the fourth issue. And we only really find out about the villain at the end of this issue. So really what we're doing in these three issues is setting the stage of the world of the DC Universe. We're starting in the 40s with the war, the end of the World War II, and we're going to the late 50s by the end of this third issue. So we're seeing the losers, which is almost the whole first issue, the losers on Dinosaur Island. At first, it seems like a non sequitur story, but this will tie in later to the villain of the story. So we're seeing how the war transitions out. The people in World War II, you know, Flag is there, and he's an important character. And then we go to the Korean War with Hal Jordan and Lois Lane, who's a war correspondent with Jimmy Olsen, and Hal Jordan is a pacifist pilot who has to end up killing a Korean soldier because, you know, it's one or the other. And then, you know, we meet John Jones, who arrives on Earth, and these are all very true to the, you know, the comic book stories.
Yeah.
John Jones arriving on Earth and becoming John Jones the detective because he's stranded, he can't return, so he's got to assimilate into the culture. Superman and Wonder Woman, which is probably the biggest sort of change. And this was an Elseworlds story at the time. This is now a Black Label story, so it's not exactly continuity. Superman and Wonder Woman are tools of the state. They're fighting the war in Vietnam for the U.S., and that's a great sequence. And then you're meeting Barry Allen, The Flash, and you're meeting all these characters. Batman shows up. You're just sort of really setting the stage for what's to come as he really starts to dig into the world and flesh out these characters, and Hal Jordan, the Suicide Squad, and Flag. And then John Henry, who's basically a new character. There's just a lot of world building in these three issues, and it's just so enveloping. You know, it's just terrific.
Yeah, I think the first time I read it when I was, you know, much younger, although I was 27, I didn't really know most of this stuff, the Golden Age, the Silver Age stuff that had set at the beginning of it. You know, I wasn't familiar with the losers, the challengers of the unknown, the Suicide Squad. A lot of that stuff had just gone past me.
It's a lot of peripheral stuff. You don't really get a lot of the meat and potatoes heroes until the second half of the book.
And I didn't know to appreciate that then, and I certainly do now. Another thing that I didn't know, even the last time that I read this, I hadn't read the right stuff. Mm-hmm. And now that I have read the right stuff, it's very apparent that Darwin had and that he liked it very much. There's stuff in here that is like straight up quotes from stuff that, you know, the Mercury 7 had said. And there's a little thing in here where, you know, Hal thought he was on his way to being part of the Mercury 7, and Colonel Flagg's just like, oh no, you're not even, they're already chosen. No, not you. Which, you know, is sort of, you know, the, because he is a weirdo pacifist and they think that he might be a little bit
communist,
you know, a little pink. There's a great bit where King Faraday shows up at the beginning. I still don't know who that is, but I know he's from this story, and I didn't have a context for that character before. But I do now, because I know a heck of a lot more history and I know a heck of a lot more what's going on. And I was like, that's one of the greatest speeches in a comic book. That actually, there's a section in there where basically King Faraday explains everything to Hal Jordan. And yep. It is the most dialogue-packed exposition in anything ever. And if it had not been written really well, it would have been bad. But at one point, just like Hal is in a capsule that they drop, you know, and he says he's just spamming a can. Now, that was something that the Mercury 7 astronauts said all the time, because they were annoyed that they didn't get to actually pilot.
Yeah, they had no control over the vehicle.
Right. You know, and the weird testing that Hal goes through at the beginning, where he's just like, there's just been months of them doing these. That's what happened to Mercury 7. And they hated it. They didn't know what the hell was going on. They thought they were pilots and they weren't. And this is a lot of what's going on there. This story ends up different for Hal. There's a lot of that. And Chuck Yeager at the beginning.
Oh, great.
Hal says something about wanting to be at the top of the pyramid. And that is a running theme through the right stuff, and how, you know, pilots were always climbing up the ziggurat of the pyramid to try to get to be the best pilot as possible. And they had a very specific personality type. And you see that that's what Hal Jordan is, except for that one thing, that right. He won't kill anybody. And I think that is super interesting. And it lets that guy be a superhero.
The first issue can be challenging if you don't realize what you're looking at, because the first issue is mostly Dinosaur Island. So if you get this book called DC, The New Frontier, and you're expecting Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and you're getting the losers fighting dinosaurs on Dinosaur Island for the most part, and then a Watchmen-esque contextual magazine from the time talking about the death of the Hourman. It's like, what did I just read?
Totally. You know? And I wasn't in a position to really get that, but the last couple of times I read it, you know, that last bit where he jumps into the mouth of the beast, what an incredible segment. That was my desktop, you know, on like my iPad for years. Yeah, I still put it back every once in a while. Man, that is some comic booking.
You know, it's a series of vignettes as we build the worlds. And so looking back on it, you know, the Superman Wonder Woman sequence in Vietnam is terrific. The stuff with Lois Lane when she meets Hal Jordan in Korea is terrific.
The Flash story
that's my favorite. It's sort of cliche, but the story in Vegas in which a lot of the luminaries in the DC universe are there to watch Ted Grant fight Muhammad Ali, and there's a sneaky little Alan Scott cameo. And then Captain Cold shows up to, you know, wreck havoc, and so that Barry runs to Iris's rescue, because Iris is also there with Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle and Oliver Queen. They're all there for the fight, and they're all in 60s suits, and it's all very glamorous and Rat Packy. And then you have great Flash story, and it ends with this great image of snow in Vegas, and it's just this wonderful swinging 60s-esque sequence where it just makes you feel like DC, and it's not in the 60s, it's the late 50s, but it's that same era. Yeah. It makes you feel like DC should always take place in this time.
Yeah, but not everybody could do it.
Right, and that's the problem.
You know what I mean? Like,
and that's the problem.
Well, also, this is actually probably a really good time. We are over the moon here about what Darwin has done here. But I don't know if it's the first segment, but that is a segment where the coloring of Dave Stewart really stands out.
Oh, for sure.
Like, could not be more perfect for the story that's being told. Like, this was one of the first examples of me sort of like getting like, oh, that's what's good about color. That's when it works. That's when overcoloring and the contrast of that bright red against all the blue and just thoughtfulness going into everything. You know, I don't feel like I know enough to talk about why the color is great all the time, but like all through this thing, it's just perfect. You know, there's a reason that Dave Stewart won the Eisner for color pretty much every year. I don't even know if he had to do something that year. There's just nobody better than him yet, you know, until people came along later, you know, to basically take what he'd done and apply it to stuff too, you know, or build on top of it. But like, he was the innovator, you know, it's almost like he's the Jack Kirby of coloring. Like, he's just,
it doesn't look like a Dave Stewart Dark Horse book. It doesn't look like a Hellboy book.
No. Yeah. It's a good point.
It's appropriate for the story. It's very primary colory, even though there's lots of thoughtful coloring here. It's very pop arty. You know, the colors are bright. The Flash is bright red. Superman's bright blue and red. There's no hiding what we're looking at here. I'm scrolling through the thumbnail, you know, on Comixology to look at the pages, and you can just see the pops of color, you know, on the Flash pages and Green Lantern.
Now, this scene, this whole boxer fight and then after party thing is also really good. I want to make a little callback to a conversation that we had. It might have been last week. It might have been before. This is a scene where you actually have a lot of people who are not in costumes who kind of look similar.
Yeah.
It's a lot of women with dark hair that kind of have the same skin tone and a lot of men in the same way. And we were talking about this. The names are sprinkled around liberally so that every time I was like, wait, who am I talking to? They were saying everybody's name at every possible chance. And I was like, that is old school comic booking in a big way. Like I'm looking at it now and I just like, they just keep saying the names and it actually doesn't feel like it sticks out all that much, but I always knew who everybody was.
Because people do say each other's names. And even though, and also even though we didn't know that was Alan Scott sitting in the crowd, we got a sense that this blonde guy in the white tux jacket next to Selena was somebody. You know, later on, a few pages later, someone says, hey, I saw Alan Scott earlier. And so obviously that, you know, so like, even if it doesn't happen right then, you have it in play. You know that this other blonde guy is Oliver Queen. You know that clearly this is Bruce Wayne and it's just Lois Lane. And it's just very solid in terms of fundamentals. Which is sort of an understatement for Darwin Cook because he's all about fundamentals. There's never a question of who is this side character? Who is King Faraday? In a comic now, King Faraday might show up and you just may not even know who he is. You know, you may be expected to know based on the art. It's a feast. It's a visual feast. And then, you know, there's lots of things going on here. There's the whole, you know, disturbing John Henry side story with the Klan. And that's, you know, dealing with the racism of the 50s and 60s that's happening.
Very interesting how that has a lot in common with what they did in the Watchmen TV show.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
A lot of that there, which I think is, and I listened to all the podcasts about that, and Lindelof never mentioned this, but it was very familiar to that to me. And I know that they were working on Hood of Justice, but the Hood of Justice that was in The Watchmen is not that character.
No.
But the one in the TV show was a lot like this.
There's a couple of bits with the art where there's one point where John Jones is at the movies because he loves to go to the movies because he can really soak in everyone's emotion, and it's very intense for him. And they're watching Fox Movie Tone, which is something that Josh and I used to work with. And just the way he draws black and white, it's not colored black and white, although it is. It's the way he draws it. It just looks different than the rest of the world. And it's just the art in it is just so, it's just so good.
You should theoretically, black and white art is not the same thing as it's just regular art without color.
Yeah, for sure. You know,
that's not the way that works. I think the other thing that became apparent to me, and I've said this before, but every time I go back to it, I'm reminded of it, is that for most of the characters in here, this is my favorite version of them.
Yes.
And I know why they can't do that in other comics, and I know, but nowhere has it been so clear, you know, the Flash in this. I was like, why isn't every Flash comic just like that Flash?
Exactly.
You know, and well, no, it's like the thing where we're back where we used to talk about, like, should Spider-Man be married? Should this? And like, this presents a very good argument for why it's ridiculous to make these people old.
Yes.
You know, the Hal Jordan in this is the most clearly defined Hal Jordan I've ever read. Same thing with Martian Manhunter. In a very short amount of time, I understand who that character is and the whole thing about them. And it makes you realize how much people don't understand them and how sort of vague all of these different representations are. And I think it's very hard to do that.
Oh, it's not easy. But I had the same thought while I was reading it that people often ask this, what would you do if you were in charge of DC or Marvel? I would hand everyone this graphic novel again. Even though you assume that most of them have read this and almost all of them have who are making comics. This is it. This is the heart of DC Comics here. And it's completely not relevant to what's happening in the comics right now. And that's partially why it's not as interesting.
Well, we used to play this exercise. I remember being in San Diego, and I think it's because it was actually happening. Somebody teased us with something. Somebody was about to write Superman. And they said, you know, they said to us, they were like, I don't have an artist yet. Who's the best person you would put on it? And we all like reconvened and we were just like, Darwin. Like, and this is before we'd had him on the show. We knew him. But I couldn't think, like, none of us could think of somebody who would be able to do Superman better from an artistic standpoint. Now, to be fair, he should have just written it too. But I wouldn't have wanted Darwin on monthly superhero comics or anything because I don't think that's where he would shine.
He was looking to do it. They never offered it to him. He would have been happy to. And they just never offered him a monthly book.
And he said that, ironically, that what this book did to him in comics was to pigeonhole him as a Silver Age guy.
Right.
Which completely misses the point.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is a great setup to a payoff that's going to happen later. Issue 4 is Hal Jordan finally gets his ring and heroes start to come together. And this first three issues is almost like, here is an overview of the DCU at this time. Here's an overview of the DCU in the 50s. Here's what all the main characters are doing. Here's a Batman that's still in the Golden Age version of Batman. Still acting like the Golden Age version of Batman.
It's a great Batman. That's one, I don't know if I'd call it my favorite Batman. Like, this is my favorite Hal Jordan. It's my favorite Wonder Woman by far. Favorite Martian Manhunter. Probably favorite Flash. I don't know if it's my favorite Batman, but it is a Batman at a time that was really cool. I sent you a panel at one point, and it was basically Batman's rescuing a kid. And, you know, Slam Bradley is describing how he's, you know, like the meanest fighter he's ever seen. And by the way, Slam Bradley's eyelids are my favorite thing in this comic book. It's just his sleepy eyelids. I was like, that's amazing. And I'm sure that there is a Golden Age movie star who he looks like, but I wasn't sure.
Oh, he's Robert Mitchum.
That's it. That's totally it. Yep. I was like, it's like Dean Martin's eyes, but not drunk. Like, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, it's Robert Mitchum. Anyway, basically, Batman's trying to rescue this kid from these violent cultists who are going to sacrifice him. And finally, he beats all the guys down, and he goes over to the kid to save him. And the kid starts screaming because Batman is scary. So in the first panel, he's, you know, sort of determined and going towards the kid. In the second panel, the kid screams and Batman like reels back, like confused and surprised. Right. And I was like, in those two panels, that was so much storytelling. And I've also never seen that face on Batman.
Right.
But if he was that age, he probably wouldn't, like, he's determined. He wouldn't realize that he would scare the shit out of a kid. It never would have occurred to him. And it would have taken him
back. He hasn't taken Dick on yet.
Yeah.
So he hasn't learned to not scare the kids.
Robin does show up in this later, right?
Well, that's the transition from Golden Age Batman to Silver Age Batman happens
right
in between these next, you know, the issues where we stopped reading. Yep. There was only one point in this book where I stumbled on the storytelling, and that I think was a lettering issue because I think the balloon was too high. But other than that, I mean, it's a cliche to say that Darwin is a master class in storytelling, but he is. He tells a whole a volume of storytelling within just three panels a page. It's really incredible what he does with character work, what he does with the fundamentals of physicality and storytelling and giving everyone a different face, giving everyone a different look, giving everyone a personality. It's a prime example of how you don't need a million lines on a page to do your job.
I think this was probably the book that convinced me that you shouldn't have a million lines on every page.
Right.
You know, like, I was always leaning towards sort of cartoony stuff at a certain point. But when I really got this, I thought, oh, that's the perfect, because it doesn't lose anything. Usually there's a trade-off.
Right.
You know, and we, like, when I was younger, much younger, I would have said, you know, like, man, like, the guys that draw more photorealistic and there's all that stuff, you know, but that doesn't actually convey emotion to me as well now. I don't like it as much at all because it feels, I don't know, too real, whereas this, it's so much easier for the cartoony guys. Not easier, but they can just tell you the story instead of worrying about making sure that, you know, this looks completely real. But Darwin treads that line perfectly. Like, there's nothing looks wrong. The anatomy, the perspective, the build, like, it's all right, but it's just not laborious. It seems effortless.
And the world's full. He does full backgrounds when they're called for, but also doesn't when they're not called for. He really is, it's whatever the story needs at the moment. As an artist who came from animation, he wasn't sort of tied into those comic book tropes. You know, he wasn't someone who only had drawn comics and so, you know, sort of recycles comic tropes over and over and over again. It was like, it was a fresh perspective on all this stuff, which was nice.
Also, if I might go way into nerd bit, I'm not sure that he's drawing all of the sound effects on the board, but it looks like it. And aside from that, there's a lot of lettering in this, in the background, the Ferris, you know, like signs, the signs in the background of Gotham City, the posters have sort of, I'm looking at like the periodic table of elements that he drew behind Barry in his office. And then, you know, like the writing on there and the signage, you know, as the Flash runs by. Like I said, this is a full-on illustration.
Yes.
Oh, you know, yeah. Like, and it's all of the things that I don't know what people are still taught now. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying it used to be this way or that, but it used to be. I am saying it apparently. I feel like if modern comic book artists are taught that stuff, they don't use it in the work all that often anymore. You know, a lot of these guys, when they would sort of learn how to be illustrators, they would learn how to draw, they would learn how to illustrate letters, they would, like, that was all part of that.
It was all part of the illustrative process, which is not.
Yeah, and now, you know, everything's pretty segmented, so any letters that go in that comic book are done by a letterer in his computer. You just don't see that on the board lettering, all that. I don't even just mean the balloons, but, like, everything is sort of digitally added in later, and it's a real lost art, and that's why, you know, I know that I used to be able to appreciate Chris Ware. you know, but then one day I went to a museum and I saw Chris Ware pages and I just thought, oh, these are all
giant.
Like, they're A, yes, they're giant, but B, like every letter and Darwin illustrated this too with the Spirit miniseries that he did.
Yes.
Where the title pages were always stylized letters and things like that. But it really does, it's a fuller illustrator sort of profile. And again, you know, this was a prestige project. He got to be in control of it, work on it. But I don't know anybody who does this anymore.
It's incredible. It was a joy to reread in the giant format and just pour over it. And I mean, should we spoil that next week we're doing part two?
I mean, I should hope. I mean, I would be angry at us if we did.
We'll return next week for the part two. We'll talk more about the story because it really sort of kicks off next part.
Yeah, the next part's definitely more plot heavy, and I think we'll get a little less philosophical on things, but maybe not. Maybe we'll get more.
So that was the pick of the week, and I apologize for the other comics that came out this week.
Connor sent me his list, and he's like, are you ready? Are there comics you want to talk about? And I was like, no. I've read several others, but it's funny because like we're not going to talk about Swamp Thing, but I read Swamp Thing this week, and I was like, oh, yeah, he was totally right last week. It was like it was exactly what you said it was last week.
I didn't read it, so good to know. So the three main DC books came out. The first one was the Green Lantern Season 2, number 3, from Grant Morrison, Liam Sharp, Tom Orzechowski. Did you read this?
I did.
What has happened to this book?
Trying to remember if I liked it or not.
Remember how good it was when it first came out? And then it was like the first half of the first season was really, really good to the point where I bought Ron for Christmas the collection of the first six issues. Because the first six issues were incredible. And then once the Dark Black Stars thing happened, Black Stars or Dark Stars?
Dark Stars.
Once that happened.
Black Stars. I don't know.
I feel like the book completely lost its way when that happened. It's never returned. And one of the highlights has been Liam Sharp's art. And this issue, he does this weird painterly style, but it's also interspersed with his regular style. And I couldn't figure out why it would change. Like, there was no real story reason for it to change.
I went back to the beginning. I was like, wait, who's drawing this? And I was like, oh, it's Liam Sharp. It's really interesting that he can do this other style. I would like him to stop, though.
It just didn't work. It just felt, you know? It didn't work. And if the whole issue was like that as an experiment, fine. But then there would be random pages and or panels within a page of his regular drawn style. And I was like, why is this happening? I couldn't figure it out story-wise, why they would switch the art around.
It's genuinely impressive. Except it just so happens that that's a style I don't like. It looks very digitally.
Yeah, it looks like airbrushed.
Yeah, and I just like the line work that he does so much.
Look at page 6 in your digital reader, right? So the top panel where Hal's visiting his buddy in the hospital after he's crashed his experimental jet. It's the top panels is basically the old drawn style, and then the rest of the page is all his painted style. I don't know why it's switched that way.
Look at page 14, and you've got sort of the spaceship being picked up. The spaceship is drawn in line style.
Yes.
And the characters aren't, but then
the characters are drawn in line style there. That's his drawing.
But then all around it, it's this weird.
The effect of Hal in the cockpit of this experimental jet, where he's the engine is red behind him, that kind of worked for me. I liked the way that looked, but I didn't like the way overall the book looked. And I also just don't know what's going on with this book anymore. The stories are all over my head, and
it was weird that they had these Porg things.
Yeah,
that were there for kind of
reason, really.
I understand, you know, it's Grant Morrison. He does weird things and he wants to have fun with it. He wants to do all that stuff. But this one, it hasn't been working for me. It's getting to the thing where sometimes you're Grant Morrison and you'd be like, oh, wow, that's Grant Morrison. And now I'm reading one, this is Grant Morrison? And that's kind of what it feels like. It feels like somebody trying to do Grant Morrison.
The first six issues were the first Grant Morrison. Like, holy shit, this is incredible.
Right.
You know, why is no one talking about this? And now it's like, I couldn't in good conscience recommend this book because I don't understand what's happening.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer.
I know that this was the story, and it was the story point where he wouldn't take his ring with him to fly the experimental plane.
Right.
And I got that. Honestly, if that had happened at the point of the story, when Darwin Cook's story in The New Frontier, I would have said, yeah, that makes sense. But this point later, when he's like the big top badass, you know, Green Lantern cop guy, I just think later along, he'd be like, no, that's irresponsible. I can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it both ways.
I can too.
What's interesting is this is the most Hal Jordan like the one in New Frontier.
That's true.
That we've seen in quote-unquote regular comic. This is very much like Chuck Yeager, Hal Jordan, as opposed to other books. So this is that's what's interesting about having coming out this week when we're talking about New Frontier as well.
That's part of the reason that I could buy it, but it did just feel like a plot point because, you know, that guy, it's not the guy who we've seen in the book so far.
It's an excuse to have him when they crash. He doesn't have a way out, but like it's been happening throughout the whole series, this one where he hasn't been wearing his ring while he's been flying. You're right. At certain points, like, well, what are you trying to prove?
That's
here?
Just stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, we were just talking about the right stuff, guys. That fits in with that. But, you know, it's like the thing where it made more sense for a lot of the guys to crash their planes than eject.
Yeah.
But actually, that was mathematical based. I could go on anyway. But yeah, you're right. Like, it was a thing that I really looked forward to. And then it became a thing that I was hesitant about. And now it makes me wonder, am I missing something?
Right.
And I don't like that.
Hawkman 23, Robert Venditti still writing, Marcio Takara and Fernando Pissarin are trading off art duties with Jeremy Cox on colors and Rob Lee on letters. And I actually really like this. It's funny because I joked because we'd already picked New Frontier before the comics came out. And I was like, well, I guess if Hawkman's really good, I'll feel bad. But Hawkman turned out to be really fun, although a little too close to home as we've continued to journey through time and space in Hawkman's past. Here we're in Seville, Spain in 1650, where Hawkman is dealing with the plague. And I was like, no, can't do that right now. Too close to home.
When would that have been written, do you think?
Well, I don't know. Because
it might have been written as this was all happening, like
maybe
December. Like, you know, before it was a real thing, but like, oh, that's interesting. That sort of makes me think of this. And then he wouldn't have known what it would have turned into. But that's it, just, you know.
It was a really fun issue, even if I was like, at the beginning, I was like, But they've brought back Shiera, who hasn't been Hawkwoman in years. Their pairing is really fun. And, you know, the stuff from back then when he's the doctor, because he's been all these different people throughout time. So he's this doctor in Spain, and he's trying to help people with the plague. But they think he's the reason why everyone's getting sick, and so they're going to burn him at the stake. And he gets saved by Shiera, and they're both wearing this creepy bird mask, which you can see on our Instagram page. It was really fun, legitimately. It might have been my favorite of the three DC books I read this week outside of New Frontier.
Cool.
But actually, you also really enjoyed The Flash 753, which is funny. They're sticking with the original numbering.
I like those artists.
You know, we've had this weird roller coaster with Flash where it's been like, it was good for a while, it was bad for a while, and then every once in a while it's good. There was a good arc with year one, but then it went back to bad again. So I never know what I'm going to get with The Flash, but here... This is Josh Williamson with art by Howard Porter and Brennan Peterson.
Ooh.
This is almost like a reset issue. It's not, but if you were at all curious about The Flash, this would be a good place to check out where Barry realizes he needs the help of the Reverse Flash in what he's doing. So he has to travel through time to try to find him and recruit him. And so we're treated to a lot of sort of Flash greatest hits as he bounces around through time on a cosmic treadmill. Love the cosmic treadmill. One of my favorite Silver Age devices. I also really love that there are so many things that we accept as comic readers because they've always been there no matter how dumb they are, and one of them is calling a character Reverse Flash and taking it totally seriously.
I literally remember running across that character the first time, running across. That wasn't on purpose. And just thinking, really? That's what you're... And then you just go with it. You're fine.
They even do it on the TV show. It's just like we all just accept that this objectively stupid name is going to work for us and make sense, and he's a really dangerous and cool character, so we even find it sort of foreboding.
Then you give him a first name that you can't even pronounce.
Eobard.
Eobard.
It helps to watch the TV show. But it's just like you step back and go, this is really silly, but also we've been dealing with it for 40 years, so who cares?
50. More.
Again, Eobard's wearing the classic Reverse Flash costume, and Barry's got the new dumb one, so again, I don't know where my allegiances totally lie here. This is like an overview issue. We see Flashpoint, we see stuff from his mom, we see the future with the Flash Museum, and he bounces around time, we get a Flash overview, and then at the end he convinces Eobard he's got to help him. If you're at all curious, this would be a good issue actually to jump onto.
Like, I know we're way behind, and I just want to, like, this, what you just explained to me had a lot to do with why I like the Flash in New Frontier. It's just like his mother and the Flashpoint. I'm like, ugh, I don't want the Flash haunted by his dead mother.
We don't
it's
need,
so
every character doesn't
fun.
Need pathos. Because the cool thing about the Flash, is, and Barry Allen in particular, because Wally was sort of haunted by the death of Barry, but Barry was the comic geek who got superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, this is cool. You know?
Yep.
Even in New Frontier, you see him reading an old Flash comic.
Yep.
He was the readership surrogate who got powers, and isn't this awesome to be hanging out with Superman?
Yep.
Every character's Batman now, and everyone's haunted and... Et cetera, et cetera. So let's not even get into it. This is a bad comparison
week
for some of these characters.
This episode is brought to you by Quarantine, not the one you're living, but Quarantine, the 40-page crazy sci-fi one-shot comic with each page drawn by a different incredible artist and written by Frank at Home on the Farm writer and iFanboy patron Jordan Thomas, and featuring a cover by Derek Robertson, who I love, co-creator and artist on The Boys, Transmetropolitan, and Happy. There's some amazing artists working on the book, including former Hellblazer artist Gary Erskine, 2000 AD artist Shaky Kane, Emma Kubert, Clara Meath, Craig Patton, and Gustavo Vargas. The story focuses on the Loon family, whose apartment building is sent for quarantine in an alternate universe without reason. Kept in their apartment by guard bots that patrol the halls, things get stranger and stranger until the family ends up closer than they have ever been before. Picture J.D. Ballard mixed up with H.P. Lovecraft and a little bit of Rick and Morty in there. Quarantine is live to buy on Kickstarter now until June 1st. Simply search Quarantine on Kickstarter in the comics section or visit at Jordan_J_Thomas on Twitter to find the link. We will make sure that there's a link there on the iFanboy page for this show.
Yep.
Original pages, merchandise, and a huge back catalog of the creator's previous work are also available. There's one story, 28 artists, and no escape. So go check that out, Quarantine.
If you're a patron and you're on our Discord server, he's been showing us off a lot in the fan art and other projects channel. So he's been working on this for a while, and exciting. He's got some big names on it.
For sure. So there was actual patron pick this week, and yeah. I had forgotten about it. But you made that happen.
Enough comics came out, we decided to bring the patron pick back, as well as all these motorcycles. And the patron pick ended up by a wide margin being Bad Karma number 1, which is published by Panel Syndicate. Written by Alex DeCampi, art by Ryan Howe, colors by Dee Cunniff, and Alex DeCampi also lettered it. And this is the second Panel Syndicate book we've talked about this during this quarantine time. And it beat Green Lantern Year One by about 10 percentage points. So it went pretty handily.
Mm-hmm.
Alex DeCampi is a name I see all the time, but I don't think I've ever actually read anything she's written before. I couldn't find anything. But I see her name pop up in places.
She's done a couple of Image series. Yeah, I've seen her name around for a long time, but she's never really done like mainstream, you know, Marvel, DC right. stuff, but it's part of the scene, and it's escaped me. But
she writes animation and other stuff. She said in her back. It's just a name that sticks with you. It's a very unusual name, and
yes.
And so I was like, oh, interesting. I've never actually read anything she's done, so that's fun. And so Bad Karma is a story of two U.S. war veterans who are home and dealing with various PTSD and physical injuries that they've dealt with. Now there's obviously a story happening under here, although for the most part, this issue is mostly about them in their lives on Christmas. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I guess so.
It opens up where they go to a prison and say, hey, dude, you're about to be executed for this murder. We actually did it. We want to help you. And then we flash back to before leading up to that point. One of the guys, he only has PTSD. He doesn't have any physical injuries. So he's still an active military contractor. His buddy is missing his...
Private military contractor.
Right. His buddy's missing his leg and other parts of his body. He's not. And so this is all somehow involved with something they did before and killed a dude. And we don't know anything about that, but this is mostly about them dealing with the one dude's ex-wife's or ex-girlfriend's family and that kind of thing. What did you think of this?
So the other thing I think that is important to know here is that, and there's a lot of context clues, if you know to look for them, is that this takes place, you know, in Boston.
Yeah.
Around, you know, like in Quincy, in Southie, they're around there. And the characters, once you realize that, that's how they're talking. Like at one point, somebody says, Wicked. And you're like, once I, you know, there's a Boston hat. And at one point, the woman gets off the plane. She's got those Patriot sweatpants that are on every third woman in Boston who isn't going to a professional job.
Right.
I did wish, though, that was a little more obvious. Like, they were subtle about it, but they didn't write the accent phonetically or anything like that, so it took me a little while to come onto it. So it's at the same time, like, it felt sort of authentic, but also almost just slightly too subtle before I picked up on it.
Well, I mean, the guy's wearing a Red Sox hat, and they leave the airport in the beginning. He's like, fucking Boston, because it's really cold out. And I mean, it was pretty early on.
Yeah, no, I get it. I just didn't – I don't know. Like, I wanted, like, the big thing that – yeah, I don't know, because they were flying all over the place. I think the point is, though, is that I really normally like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And my take on this whole book was that I almost liked a lot of it, if that makes sense. Like, if I'm glancing through the art, I think, oh, it looks pretty good. But then I'll get to things every once in a while, like, not quite, though.
It's almost there. And it has a very...
Yes.
Who was the Why the Last Man artist?
Pia Guerra?
Very Pia Guerra-esque quality to it. And for the most part, I liked it, but every once in a while there'd be a panel where the arm was way too short or something strange was going on.
There's an authenticity to it because the car they get in is like an old Subaru wagon, like the old boxy kind from the 80s. But like it doesn't look like looks like a Google SketchUp.
Right.
I don't know if that's still a thing. I think it used to be. I don't know. It's just, and then there's like, they go down into the basement of the house that they're in, and like the person didn't want to draw, you know, the ceiling. Just look, it's like, it's almost good, but that it's a little off. The cartooning is almost expressive, but it's a little stiff. And the coloring is almost good, but it's a little digital gradient-y. And the story is almost interesting, but it's kind of familiar. It doesn't have whatever that extra spark is. It's not, I know it's all Boston, and I think it's real enough. Whoever wrote this, I think, is very familiar with it. But it's not quite as fun as watching Mark Wahlberg and Martin Sheen yell in the accents.
And people should note that Josh currently lives in New Hampshire.
Oh, but I grew up in New England. Well, that's fucking appropriate. I fucking live here.
I think the biggest problem was there wasn't enough story in the first issue. You know, for a book like this,
that's true.
You really need to get the hooks in. And now the idea that they killed this dude and someone else is going to be executed for it is interesting, but I don't know enough details about happened.
I think that's a good point, is that there was not. So you had that thing in the beginning where like, hey, we think we killed that person. And then they used up a couple of pages. That was fine. But by the last page, they see the dude on the news.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, then what are we going to do, Sully? Which I read like in the Kevin Smith movie, the Bad Will Hunting, I think it was. But you're right. It's not quite enough. Like, how does that, like, they didn't tell us that we needed a little more. Again, it was almost that thing, but it wasn't quite.
If you read the article in the back, the standard article in the back explaining what you just read, she wants to explore PTSD and coming out of the war and male friendships as much as she does the plot, which is totally fine. And I really enjoyed the scene with the family, which was, it felt like most of the issue, the dinner scene. Mm-hmm. But that took up so much real estate that I don't know enough about the plot to know if I want to keep going, even though I did really enjoy it.
And also that scene, you're right, was good, but also I didn't really know who they were.
Right.
So like I hadn't spent enough time with any of the characters individually. When you put them all together, I don't know the context of what those conversations are. And then finally, you know, just I am ragging on it, I guess, or whatever, but I know that like the idea was we want to explore PTSD in soldiers. And she said, you know, like I've grown up around men, you know, who are like this and whatever. And obviously you're in Boston, you're familiar with this. I'm so sick of the essay explaining what I just read. Yeah. If you didn't put it in the story, I don't want to hear about it. Put it in the trade if you must, but you shouldn't have to. In fact, you should not want to. But the story didn't come off that way to me. And partially because it felt at first like, especially given the first couple of pages, it felt like, Christ, what's the name of the book? The Steve Lieber, Nick Spencer book.
The Fix.
The Fix.
That disappeared. That's never, never to return.
Like. It felt like a farcical, you know, sort of buddy comedy kind of thing. And graphically, it's hard to switch from that over to what she's talking about thematically. And maybe they could get there eventually. But it wasn't front and center.
It's tough because it's a very admirable subject to want to explore.
Yes, 100%.
And I think there's some sequences that really work where the guy desperately wants a drink, but his kids come home and it's the struggle between wanting to go hug his kids and wanting to drink. And then even when he's hugging the kids, he's looking at the whiskey bottle. And there was a lot of really good stuff in here.
There's truth and authenticity in here for sure. Yes. But I think it was all just missing a step. It wasn't tied together quite enough. You know, the art didn't quite do like it. The things that weren't clear, like there were decisions that weren't made, I don't think, the right way.
Yeah. It's tough. I don't think it was bad.
No, it isn't.
I was hoping to really be blown away and really want to read the next issue, and I didn't really have that when I got to the end of it. So let's do the ratings on it. Ratings.
Ratings.
Out of 5 stars, I'm going to give it 3.
3.
Sticking with
it. I should love this.
Yeah.
I might read the next one because first issues are weird.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll sort of write itself because a lot of these things near this sounds like, and I was reading it and I was finding myself sort of being like, ugh, this isn't. And I thought, you know, you always complain that everything has a supernatural element and it isn't, and this doesn't. This is straight up exactly what I've asked for, but it wasn't exactly what I wanted.
I like that you have a conversation with yourself. I like that.
All the time. I wish I could shut myself up.
All right. So that's Bad Karma #1 from Panel Syndicate. You can go to panelsyndicate.com. You can buy it at any price. That's what Panel Syndicate does. So if you want to pay 50 cents or 10 cents or $10. So let's talk about the patron powers. That's how we reward our $5 or higher patrons who are over at patreon.com/fanboy. The ones who voted on the patron pick. Every patron gets a vote in the patron pick. But the patrons at the $5 higher level get their own superpower. So we're going to thank Greg Reinhardt. And Josh, do you recall those famous commercials from our childhood, our youth? Calgon, take me away.
I do.
When Greg has a luxurious bubble bath, mm-hmm. not necessarily using Calgon, but just any kind of luxurious bubble bath, he can then find himself whisked away to wherever his fantasy is currently in his head.
I thought he would have to yell it like He-Man and say, I have the power. And Calgon, take me away!
Well, he has to think or say that phrase, even if he's not using Calgon, but he will be taken away to wherever he is imagining he is not currently. Now, people may not want to leave their luxurious bubble bath, but maybe they want to be having that bubble bath in Bermuda or Bahama or, come on, Pretty Mama, anywhere there's not a virus happening. I don't know. I'm just trying to, you know.
There's the moon, the space.
It's really hot here, and also I just want to be out of here. So that's what...
The International Space Station.
That's what Greg, can do. He can take himself away.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Every day Ryan Mount wakes up, mm-hmm. he's greeted by the reanimated or once again alive personage of one celebrity who died prior to that. And that person follows him around all day, you know, whether they get along or don't, if it's annoying or fascinating. This first day is like, oh, I was with Montgomery Clift all day on Thursday. And then.
So for 24 hours, he has a ghost celebrity buddy. Every day?
Every day is a new one. They're corporeal. They're a real person. They're in his house. He wakes up. They're on the couch.
Does he get repeats?
No. I mean, I think there's enough, I'd think. You know, he might not know all of them. Like, you know, I was in gangster movies in the 30s, you know, then one day it's like Adam Yauch is here. Awesome. And then, you know, he's hanging out with Jimi Hendrix one day. So he thought he'd like him more. Lennon was a prick, you know?
Yeah, I guess there's probably enough between music and TV and movies. And
Yeah. Artists, what have you.
Can anyone else see them or just him?
No, they can see him. But I'm going to put this on it. They don't really like know who the people are. You know, like it's just like a person sitting. You wouldn't now see.
That doesn't make any sense, because if it's John Lennon, people would recognize John Lennon.
I know, but I don't want the thing to be that they just walk around getting mobbed in public and freaked out because some guy looks like...
They have to be ghosts then.
Well, maybe they would think that they're just like an impersonator. That's it. That's the thing.
So people either don't recognize him or think they're impersonating.
Maybe what he did was he spun this into a business where...
he then hires them out for parties?
Exactly.
He doesn't know he's got any day, though. Like, he's got a book, Edward G. Robinson, today.
It's not an easy business.
Who needs Edward G. Robinson today at a car wash opening?
I mean, like, that's, you know, listen, Ryan spends a lot of time at his desk with his hands on his temples just going, oh, God.
Just waiting for the day Marilyn Monroe comes.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you to Greg and Ryan for being $5 or higher patrons. And that's happening over at patreon.com/iFanboy, where we've hit our next stretch goal, which is the Media Explode show and the old video show uploads, which are happening rapidly. And our next stretch goal is the quarterly barbecue and email video show that we used to do, which we'll start doing again once we hit our next stretch goal. So go over to patreon.com/iFanboy, and that is where you'll find that. And we appreciate the support. Also, iFanboy.threadless.com, that's where you find our t-shirts. We call them t-shirts, but it's really our designs that can be put on any product they sell there. The iFanboy logo, her and Pick the Week podcast, ratings if one is Electro, GDAT, Nothing Makes Something Matters. New design is Stay Home and Read Comics, which is taking the world by storm. It's rapidly becoming our number one design, which is great because a portion of all the sales will go to Comic Book United Fund, which is the new fund that benefits comic stores directly. And as soon as this sort of settles down, we'll send them a check so you can help support stores, so you can sport a great message, which is stay home and read comics. I was wearing one on a Zoom call the other day, and someone was like, oh, that's a cool shirt. I gave them the URL.
And beginning May 10th, all of our regular t-shirts in our store are $15.
That's a bargain.
It's a good bargain. This sale is a week long. It ends next weekend, May 17th. So check it out if you want some discounted t-shirts.
iFanboy.com/support. That's where you can help us out directly via PayPal, which people have done in the past. And thank you. And iFanboy.com/Amazon. That's where you can find links for the Book Explodes. You can find there, and also a general link for shopping. And we thank everyone who does that, supporting the show. We realize this, times are really hard for everybody. We're no exception. So any support you can throw away, we do appreciate that. So thank you very much. So let's move on with the show. And... let's welcome Ron Richards to the show.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Ron's here.
How you doing?
And we're talking about G.I. Joe. We're in G.I. Joe Corner, G.I. Joe Real American Hero. And this is exciting because we're in the next volume, The Revenge of Cobra. This is part one, In the Cobra's Pit, which aired a year later, September 10th, 1984. But the same team, Dan Thompson directing, Ron Friedman writing and producing for Marvel Productions. And this is much more... The G.I. Joe you'll think of and remember.
Wherever they were outsourcing the animation to, they leveled up.
What really got me about this is that the new opening sequence in and of itself...
So many more toys!
...could be the subject of a G.I. Joe corner alone, not even the episode itself. Like, I had to watch the opening two or three times because it was just going so fast. I'm like, oh, there's Spirit, there's Cutter, there's... Yeah, so it was great. Yeah.
And they changed the opening song, which used to say Cobra and Destro, to Cobra the Enemy, which adds an extra syllable.
Yes.
Cobra the Enemy.
Which, to be honest, is more accurate.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're basically folding Destro into Cobra's org chart with that change. So that's fine.
But at this point, if this is picking up from the last miniseries, Destro is in charge of Cobra, right? Cobra Commander was captured.
I imagine they had meetings in the off season and someone was like, all right, we have to work out this Destro thing because by the end, it just didn't make sense. And they're like, yeah, well, we also had some problems with the science. Shut up. The Destro thing didn't make sense.
None of the physics worked. That's not important. So here we have, even though it's a new dawn for G.I. Joe, a new year, a new song, a new open, it's a very similar story.
I was going to say, I mean, I don't think this one will have G.I. Joe transporting some sort of technology only to be ambushed by Cobra and have them steal it. That wouldn't happen.
And
would
then
it?
Kidnap Duke. And...
No, Duke wouldn't get kidnapped again.
The first time I saw the energy core, I went, oh, you're kidding me. The next, it's another, because then I was like, there's two other parts. This is another three-part, like, do it right away, but I know it's coming.
So now what's interesting, and not to get too away, like, I want us to keep to just this episode, yeah. But the first miniseries, this miniseries, and then there were two more five-part events that happened in the lifespan of G.I. Joe that were all written by Ron Friedman, and they followed the exact same arc.
That's Ron Friedman's move.
He has a successful formula. He's going to do it until it's over.
G.I. Joe's transporting something. They get ambushed. Then someone gets kidnapped by Cobra. Then both G.I. Joe and Cobra need to span the globe to get pieces of something.
Three.
Right.
It's always three.
It's always three things. Rule and they threes. Break up into teams. And it's like literally like Ron Friedman had, like, he read one Joseph Campbell book and was like, yep, that's my story. I'm just going to do that.
And
that's
also little things like Baroness being undercover as an administrative person happened again. Like, it was all very much like, oh, this is very familiar.
But we did get a lot of new faces and we did get a lot of new folks and we got a lot of vehicles. And in fact, actually, I did some research on this episode and that there is nearly close to somewhere like 36 or 37 individual G.I. Joe and Cobra people that pop up in this episode alone.
And almost that many vehicles. If I can just say one thing in Rod Friedman's defense.
Yeah.
We're still talking about this.
Oh, it works. Fair. It works. Oh, totally. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying, you know, it's funny.
37 years later, like, my guess is that first time around, he didn't put a lot into it. I don't know. We're doing something for the toys. Who gives a shit? This one, it was like, I was doing the same thing. It was put a shitload more toys in it. And when he did that, I was a happy little boy. And now I'm a happy middle-aged man.
It's funny because if you get into the plot of it, it opens up. G.I. Joe is on this desert road in Arizona or New Mexico somewhere transporting this energy core, which is not covered anyway. It's just on top of the truck.
Well, listen, it's a dry heat, Connor.
With so many vehicles and helicopters and ships. And Cobra basically takes him out with a bunch of gliders.
Yeah.
I noticed that, and
and one trouble bubble.
That's true.
With a poorly drawn trouble bubble, and it brought me back to, like, that looks like a terrible trouble bubble when I was 8. But I like, the first thing I noticed were the vehicles that have, like, the skids and fly.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, I remember that. I thought it was really cool, and I looked it up. It's called the Skyhawk. I would like to point out that that's not how that works. there's no way that works. But it looked cool. Also, it did look a little cramped for Duke. I was like, it's a little small for you, buddy.
One of my favorite moments of this entire so I watched this episode while I was cooking dinner. And my wife was just kind of going back and forth, as you do. And that's the thing. And at one point she stopped and looked at the screen and said, is that a dog in the cockpit? Yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's Mutt in Junkyard. And she's like, the guy's name is Junkyard and he named his dog Mutt. I go, no, his name is Mutt. The dog's name is Junkyard. And then
what are you not getting about this?
That was the setup for a joke that paid off about 5 minutes later, because later in the episode, Flint crashed in the Valley of Doom or whatever it is. And he's looking for his other Joes and he's yelling out names and he's like, Mutt? Junkyard? Yep, and she stops. Yep. She goes, is he yelling for the dog? I go, apparently.
I had that same thought. I had that moment. Exactly that. Yes.
So
the Cobra attacks, and you know they're coming out of nowhere. Firefly's there, and the guy, who was the guy in the Jeep? Scrap Iron?
Scrap Iron, yes, with the helmet that the moccasin driver, it's the same sculpt, but green. Oh. Remember, there was the Cobra water boat guy has the same helmet as Scrap Iron.
I love that vehicle.
I had that Cobra Jeep. So Firefly goes in his trouble bubble, and he drops a bunch of grenades. It must have been full of napalm, because there's giant 100-foot flames block the road.
Enormous wall of fire.
Roadblock, who's in a flying machine, says, ah, we're blocked. I was like, you can fly over it or around it.
Star Trek rules. There's something right in front of them, like, oh, we can't get by it.
Half of you are in helicopters. You can go all kinds of ways to get around this fire. But then Duke and Snake Eyes are both grabbed. Snake Eyes in his new design, which looks way better in the comics and as a toy, I feel like doesn't work as well on the cartoon as the other design, because it's almost monochrome.
It gets better in the cartoon as they add more stuff to the painted-on costume aspect of this. Like, it looks a lot better than the first miniseries, mind you. Like, the first miniseries just looked like somebody put a ski mask over his head, and that was it, and goggles. But at least this, we get the signature eyes visor thing that he has, you know. And, you know, by the time we get to the G.I. Joe movie in 1987, you know, 3 years from when this was made, they add grenades, they add like more stuff to it that gives that gives the costume a little more depth. But I gotta say that this Snake Eyes, and then with the addition of Flint and Lady J, who, mind you, first crush, Lady J.
She has a flinty smoker's voice, doesn't she?
Yeah. Well,
what was funny was that I was also, as I'm cooking, I said to my wife, I said, hey, there's my first crush. And it went by so fast, and it was Scarlet. She was like, oh, is that because she looks like Jean Grey? I was like, no, not Scarlet. And then we rewound. I went to Lady J, and she looked at me. She goes, yeah, that tracks. And just walked away.
So
this modern Snake Eyes, Flint, Lady J, like, these are my G.I. Joes.
And on the other side, you had Zartan and the Dreadnoughts, and you had Storm Shadow. You had a lot more. The world opened up. A lot more of
the modern stuff. I got a lot to say about Zartan. So I remember getting the action figure of Zartan and being so excited because it was so freaking weird, and he had that hard molded.
Could you put him in water and he'd change color?
Well, that's the thing, is that you put him in the sun and he changed blue.
That's right.
And I remember, like, that's so weird. There's all this backstory and all this sort of stuff, and it just never happened in the cartoon until this episode, where it happened once, where he goes, "Ah, oh, I hate the sun," and his skin turns blue, and he says, "It blocks my chameleon powers." No explanation. Never return to that.
He doesn't use chameleon powers. He puts on a rubber mask.
Yeah, which he said, now I can do your face, but he clearly had already prepared the mask.
It's weird.
It was in he already had it. He didn't need him for anything.
He needed the voice.
We get the Dreadnoughts, who, again, as my wife is watching this, she's like, are these supposed to be the Warriors? And I was like, I feel like it's a little Warriors, a little Clockwork Orange. Like, it's an amalgam of a bunch of stuff here.
It's a little Spinal Tap.
It's also a little bit, you know, middle-aged guys from a different era dealing with punk rockers and
like it's the DC thugs.
Yeah.
Yes, right? It is.
The 80s DC thugs. But then Ripper talked. And I was like, oh, it's just Cobra Commander with a bad Australian accent.
This brings me to the thing that I didn't know. This is because I was looking at that, he spoke, and I thought, oh, that's just Chris Latta, who is also now referred to as Chris Collins. I don't know what the difference is there. It doesn't matter.
Less
what
ethnic.
What I did not know was that is also the same person who does the voice of Gung-Ho.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Which I was blown away.
He's got that much range, yet he can't do a new voice for Ripper?
It was funny because after watching the first 5 episodes and then this episode, it's like, wow, you know, they really got a lot of great vocal voiceover performances. There's a lot of there's different accents, there's different approaches and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, and then it's just Cobra Commander doing a bad Australian accent.
Well, I mean, Cobra Commander is Starscream. Exactly. There's no difference between it.
Sure.
I would say 50% of the Joes are apparently from Brooklyn in the 50s. So there's that, you know, like different neighborhoods, but pretty much the same guys. So like they had some range, but.
So one of my other favorite moments talking about range is the commanding voice of Flint as the added member of the team. So when Duke gets captured and Flint just goes, well, I guess I'm in charge now.
I knew you would love that moment.
I noticed it too.
Which is funny because Duke is Cyclops. So who is Flint?
No, Flint is Cyclops. Duke is a jerk. I've never liked Duke.
But if Flint is Cyclops, then who is Duke? Then you have to have...
Duke is Cyclops.
Xavier.
Duke no, is Xavier. No, Hawk is Xavier.
Hawk is barely in it.
Duke is Cyclops. Flint is someone else.
The X-Men G.I. Joe connections really aren't there, guys. It's a stretch. I will say that if you ever question Flint being Cyclops, Flint's quote from this episode that we all remember is, "Remember, a cobra's a snake, and a snake is sneak spelled sideways." And that is Cyclops dialogue if I've ever heard it. I had to rewind that. I'm like, what did he just say? I'm like, a snake is sneak spelled sideways. He's right.
So Cobra Commander's captured while Duke and Snake Eyes are captured by Cobra. They take Cobra Commander to the base. At first, I'm wondering why Colonel Sharp's traveling through the swamp.
I had that, but it looks like they've got their jail right there.
Well, that's because the base is in the swamp. At first, I was like, why is he in the swamp? That seems...
He had to go out and check the perimeter with the guys.
With no security. That brings in Zartan and the Dreadnoughts, who capture Colonel Sharp, put him in a tiger cage, stick him in the swamp, and they take over his identity. And they go and infiltrate the Joe base that's in the swamp with the help of undercover Baroness, now in her Dominatrix outfit, because she wasn't in that in the first...
Finally.
They bust out Cobra Commander, who I'd totally forgotten does wear the mask in this cartoon.
There's two things. Because I knew that was coming, because for some reason when I looked at the summary for the episode, it said featuring the appearance of, and I was like, oh, I didn't. But the better part for me was that happens later, but when he's escaping through the swamp Zartan's bike and just screaming like a weenie, he gets a branch caught on his helmet and it starts to pull it off. And we see that it's not a face mask, but a full dome.
Sits on top of the dome, right? Correct. Yeah.
Hey, is that line on that little marking on his helmet? Is that a shine or is that a stripe?
I think it's a stripe. No, it's a shine.
No, I think it's a shine. Well, it's not a stripe. Yeah.
It's always the same.
It's definition. It's not good animation.
Animation.
I don't know how to explain it better than that. But what I also found fascinating from this was that while that's happening, Destro and Major Blood are plotting the use of the Weather Dominator, which is the new weapon that they have where Destro can control the weather.
Destro's basically cleared out Cobra Commander's offices, moving his furniture in. That's basically what's happening.
That's what I was saying, was that Destro laughs and goes, ha ha ha, everything's going according to plan. And I thought, I'm like, oh, they meant for Cobra Commander to get captured because something's going to happen. And then when Cobra Commander comes back to base, Destro is very surprised.
Well, he's measuring for drapes.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. And then
he chokes him with mutant vines.
Well,
he still doesn't fire this guy.
Well, what I also liked was that when Cobra Commander shows up and he goes, how did you survive? And there's a Crimson Guard there, which I didn't realize we got the Crimson Guard this early.
You saw them very briefly in the attack.
Yeah, Crimson Guard were awesome. This is where Cobra Commander reveals that Zartan and the Dreadnoughts are not actually Dreadnoughts. Are not actually Cobra employees. Rather, they are mercenaries that Cobra Commander keeps on retainer for just this sort of event.
Private contract.
Yeah, exactly. And then he throws him a bag of gold coins the Crimson Guard has brought him. And I was like, what currency is that?
On a platter.
Yeah. They're Kronas.
On a platter. Now, one thing that you're talking about the Crimson Guard showing up is, I remember this all progressing a lot slower when I was a kid. I remember, when are these new guys going to show up? Now I'm like, we're six issues in and we've jumped years. And it's funny that you just said, like, then the movie came out in 87. I was like, that was only 3 years?
Yes. Yeah, it wasn't that long.
That feels like my entire childhood.
No, it was
the time span. There were 35 characters in this episode.
No.
You know, CoverGirl debuted her new suburban mom haircut. You had Barbecue. Was Barbecue in it?
No, Barbecue's not in this. He's in the opening. This is the list of the Joes that are in this episode, all right?
Wow. Yeah.
You got Breaker, Clutch, CoverGirl, Duke, Flint, Green Shirts, Gung Ho, Lady J, Mutton Junkyard, Roadblock, Rock and Roll, Short Fuse, Scarlet, Snake Eyes, Sparks, Stalker, Thunder, Tripwire, and Wild Bill.
Yes.
Wait, is Green Shirts like red shirts, or is there a character called Green Shirts?
No, they're just red shirts. Yeah, they're just regular green soldiers. Yeah,
I could see it going either way.
Yeah, exactly. And now that is matched by Cobra, which including Zartan, the Dreadnoughts, Baroness Buzzer, Cobra Commander, Cobra Officer, Cobra Trooper, Crimson Guard, Destro, Firefly, Major Blood, Ripper, Scrap Iron, Storm Shadow, Torch, Viper Pilot, and Zartan. That's a lot of people in one episode.
In 20 minutes. Now, my main takeaway from this is that a year later and a giant failure with the mass device later, Cobras learn nothing. There's a giant Cobra base somewhere, a giant fortress, and they're still capturing Joes to fight their gladiator games.
By the way, have you? Yeah, well, the gladiator games is the next episode.
Right, so but that's he says that. He says they'll be great for the gladiator game. I was like, but you're still doing it. You still wasted all of your money building a giant stone fortress somewhere.
Well, hang on. Not only a stone fortress,
that
but
goes in and out of the sand.
I was just gonna say, of all the characters in all the G.I. Joe Cobra pantheon, right? There's like one or two that are on this next level cool.
Yeah.
Right. Like that they really broke the mold. And Storm Shadow is one of them, right? Yep. We're all agreed. Storm Shadow is like one of the best characters.
It was prime time for Ninja.
All he does in this episode is pull a lever to make the base come up out of the ground. That's a little Destro goes, Storm Shadow, pull the lever. And then that's it. And that's all he does.
No, wait. Also, he said Strom Shadow. I went back and I listened and I was like, he got it wrong. And I'm pretty sure that we all were watching the thing and then Storm Shadow showed up and like all of us got whatever our little kid version of boners were. Oh, he's there. And they called him Strom Shadow, pulled a lever, and that was it. And I bet I was thrilled about it. It's the Boba Fett of G.I. Joe.
You know, in the comics, it was all about Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes, and they were the primary characters, and they had the best story, and they had really interesting arcs, and they couldn't use Snake Eyes, and we talked about this before. He doesn't talk. It's hard to have a character in an 80s cartoon who doesn't talk. And Storm Shadow becomes then sort of Spirit's archenemy for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But still, they don't do a lot with him because it's still the cartoon's mostly about Cobra Commander, Destro, Major Blood, and Baroness, and then Tomax and Zima when they show up. So there really isn't room for Storm Shadow because they get all these flamboyant, vaguely European villains to deal with.
Major Blood's voice is more annoying than any of them.
Yes.
It's really bad.
That also caused my wife to go, what is his accent? And I was like, I think it's Cockney. I'm not sure.
with his numbnuts helmet. It's just...
You know why? You know why G.I. Joe hasn't defeated Cobra is because at one point someone makes a dumb joke about using a snake finder or something and they laugh for 30 seconds about it.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
While their leaders and best fighter have been kidnapped.
I just think they realize it's not like a real threat, but he does keep the funding coming.
True.
Like, that's their move.
As long as we don't totally defeat these yahoos, we get our budget. Oh, wow, I'm looking at...
They get the best toys.
2138, and they totally forgot to color in the flag on Duke's shoulder. It's just a drawing of a flag without the colors.
I love the idea that 3 or 4 years from this point, like I 7-year-old Josh went to 10-year-old Josh and he was like, all these new characters have jumped the shark. But it felt like a decade in real, you know.
Well, back then everything felt like a...
Yeah, I know.
Well, and also this made me look into it too, because this is pre-PSAs. Like this is still just a miniseries event that happens, and like
that's why there's no PSAs, because they haven't done them yet.
Right, exactly. And
there's no shipwreck either.
And when they start the regular series, they start it with another 5-part miniseries, and they don't start like one and done episodes for literally years.
Crazy.
Like,
that is crazy.
God, I love it so much. I just love it so much. It's so great.
I did watch this episode and I was just like, it's all that I want. I really, Connor was starting to watch it and I think I have time to watch it again. And I remember trying to watch it a while ago, I think maybe when the first DVDs came out, so that would have been probably 15 years ago or something like that. And I tried to watch it, and it didn't, you know, I was like, it's not doing it for me anymore. I remember the joke being, it's just wall-to-wall action. But now that I've got some time, you know, and we can really, we've done a lot of analysis on these things, I feel like I can really savor it again for the first time due to this process.
Yeah, it's great. This is a glorious thing. So one episode in of a 5-part miniseries, you know, the world is in danger. Cobra's got a new weapon. They're going to control the weather. And then, you know, the cliffhanger is that Flint and Roadbark and Mutt and Jet are trapped in the Valley of Doom with these crazy vines that are going to attack
them. That's the next episode, is the Vines of Evil, not to be confused with the Worms of Death in the last in the last miniseries. You know what, Ron Friedman took 15 minutes to rewrite the first bunch of scripts and send them in.
I'm telling you, he had a spreadsheet with just a bunch of blanks, you know, like the something of something. Okay, great. What is that going to be? Okay, cool. Let's do it.
Oh, man. So we'll be back next week with part two of The Revenge of Cobra. We're excited.
I want to know what happens to Duke and Snake Eyes.
Don't go too far ahead. You'll ruin it.
I hope they don't have to fight each other.
That's G.I. Joe Corner. We've gone long between this and New Frontier, so no emails. contact@fanboy.com if you want to write us an email. So we get some good ones. We'll try to do some soon, although there's a lot to talk about. Let's wrap this up quick.
It's ironic that the shows are running longer when there's less comics coming out.
Oh, totally. Like, it was like, we don't know what's going to happen during these quarantine shows or whatever. Twice as long. Oh,
well, we basically replaced the 10-minute POW talk with a full books blowed.
Yeah,
so that's your extra 20 minutes.
And then 20 to 30 minutes of G.I. Joe talk. And then we're still trying to do the other stuff. So what are you going to do? Talksplode. I talked to Kelly. We're trying to find a time that works. So I will have a Kelly Thompson Talksplode for you in the near future. The Booksplode that is coming up is Jack Kirby's New Gods by Jack Kirby.
Slow going.
It's a long book. And it's very enjoyable, but it doesn't necessarily lend itself to sitting there for hours and hours at a time.
But also, now that we're reading an extra trade per week,
That is an issue.
It's taken up my Booksplode reading time. So it's going to happen. Yes,
it is.
It's going to happen.
And it's not like you're not getting enough long-form book content.
Right. We've basically done three Booksplodes this month.
True.
Next week is our Patreon hangout, which we're going to open up to everyone again because we're still on lockdown. Saturday, May 16th at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Everyone can come. We're going to revisit an old topic. That's your teaser, which will be fun. But before that is the Tiki Happy Hour. Again, open for everyone. Same day. 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. That's when me and Gordon, the intern, and a bunch of other people will drink for an hour and chat with you in the chat room before we start the hangout. So if you're around Saturday, May 16th, 5 p.m. through 7 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. through 10 p.m. Eastern, come hang out with us. It'll be fun. In the meantime, head over to fanboy.com. You find all of our podcasts. You can find out what the Pick of the Week is before the show comes up by liking facebook.com/fanboy, following @fanboy on Twitter or @fanboycomics on Instagram. Best of the Week in panels return this week because there were some comics. Individually, we are C.S. Kilpatrick on Instagram, J.A. Flanagan on Instagram and Twitter, although you're taking a Twitter break, and Ron XO on Twitter and Instagram, correct?
That's me. Yeah.
Also, as we mentioned before, our YouTube page, youtube.com/iFanboy. That's where we're updating the old video shows from the stretch goal that we hit. We've got a lot of them, new ones up there, so if you want to see them, subscribe at youtube.com/iFanboy. You'll see all the old shows. They're pretty terrible in the beginning, if we're honest.
Oh, they're not good. They're not good. They're not.
If we're honest, they get better.
They're our Ron Friedman era.
They get better.
Like, you know, there's seeds of things there that we like, but not good.
Also, somebody commented, they were like, I remember the video quality being better. I was like, nope, not those early shows.
I didn't realize that they weren't HD for a while, or I'd forgotten.
There was no HD. Yeah.
No, totally. Do you remember? It was funny because I was remembering back to in 2007 when we started doing that, and the hours it would take to upload a 15-minute episode.
It took 24 hours to upload it to Revision 3, and if your internet died at all, you had to start over.
Yeah, it was crazy.
It was really bad.
You remember that? My wife was working on a project, and we could not figure out why the files kept coming out. She'd shot some stuff on tape. She couldn't figure out why the files were coming out in non-HD. And then I go, wait a minute. We didn't have HD when you shot this. And she was like, oh, that's why they're like this. And this was like 2 days.
It's like looking at the show through gauze.
Absolutely. But that's not our fault.
No, but also we look better. All the lines are smoothed out. It's great.
In our shorts. If you like this show, this version, or whatever version of it is we're doing, you can go leave a star rating or review over on Apple Podcasts. That's awesome. Or better yet, just if you talk about it on social, not even better yet, but also good, talk about it on social media. Let people know about it. Let us know that if you enjoyed shows, if you like what's going on. If you don't, not so much, but you could. It's fine. I can't stop you. Tell your friends about us. Do that kind of stuff. Thanks to everybody who does that. Thanks to everybody who's listening. We all hope that this is helping. People have told us that it's helping them get through. And I know that I'm listening to things that are helping me get through. And this, for us, is making this a lot easier, just having this time to spend and listen to G.I. Joe and all that stuff. So thank you, everybody.
At minimum, Josh just needs somebody to talk to. So
I mean, my wife's only got so much in her.
So thanks, Ron, for coming for G.I. Joe Corner. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Connor.
I'm Josh.
I'm Ron. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to go again. I forgot. I'm rusty.
We were very confused. It's okay. Now I get it. It's fine.
Wash your hands.
Fill my heart with song. Let me sing forevermore. You are all I long.
ship and a door. In other words, please be true. In other words, in other words, I love you.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.